Carmen is a proud descendant of the Dhurrumbal and Dhurrul clans of the Birriguba Nations of Queensland. She grew up in Orange, central western New South Wales, and started her career as a registered nurse and registered midwife, as well as a women's health nursing practitioner. Over time, she began working in the policy areas of government. Until recently, Carmen was the Director of Aboriginal Health New South Wales, where she was responsible for statewide Aboriginal health policy planning and funding initiatives throughout the whole of New South Wales. She has been a clinician, educator, researcher, policy advisor, project officer, manager, and senior executive, spanning a public servant career of over 30 years, working extensively in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, including child protection laws and justice and health sectors. Carmen has a Master's in Public Administration, a Master's of Arts in Indigenous Social Policy, and was accepted as an adjunct associate professor with the Sydney Nursing and Midwifery School recently. Carmen is also pursuing her PhD. Can I welcome Carmen Potter, please?
Good morning. Thank you, Vanessa. Good morning, everyone. It's lovely to be here today. And thank you, Aunt, for welcoming us onto your beautiful country. And I was out walking this morning thinking, this is so lovely that I could move here, and then I was kindly reminded about how cold it actually gets here in Canberra, because like growing up in Orange, it has very, very much the same weather. Before I begin, I just need to acknowledge country, and in particular traditional custodians of the land, and pay my respects to my elders here today, both present and past. I just need to go to... Yep, well, thank you. The purpose of my talk today is to really provide an overview of the direction and work that the Public Health Association of Australia has undertaken in regards to supporting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health reform. I will then go on to talking about what considerations need to be taken to further the work of closing the gap. But before I begin, I just want to give you a short story of my, a quick snapshot of my life. I have, as Vanessa indicated, I'm Aboriginal. It's one part of my heritage. The other part is that I'm also South Sea Island. Another part, I've got a bit of Scottish in me too, apparently. And if you're familiar with, in particular, South Sea Islander part of Australian history, you would know that Queensland was built on the hard work of what they know as the Kanakas. And in particular, bringing in Polynesian, Melanesian people from the Pacific to work in the sugar industry of Queensland. Similarly, history in Australia would also tell you the work around moving or dislocating or moving Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people off their country. And we've watched over the years policies that have essentially dismantled the way that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander society has operated. I share this because this is part of my story. Similarly, I was 2.5 years old when the 1967 referendum got through in regards to recognising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as a race of people worthy of being counted in the census. That same referendum also gave power to the Commonwealth Government to make laws in regards to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Around that time in the 70s growing up, my life also was on the tail of the end of the practices of the Stolen Generation. Similarly, growing up in a rural regional area in Australia, you could imagine the level of discrimination and racism that my family and I was confronted with. My mother would often tell of stories in regards to only being able to go to one chemist to be able to get medication for my myself and my sisters when we were sick. And similarly, we could only access a clothing shop, which was a men's shop, where we could only buy our clothing. So we'd actually walk around in men's or young boys' clothing because that was the only shop that would deal with my mother. Similarly, I grew up in a school where I was faced on many occasions being traumatised by, in particular, violence and bullying in the school. Fortunately enough, I actually went through and completed my high school certificate, and I was one of the fortunate people. Similarly, I grew up in a family where there was alcoholism and violence. Again, I'm one of the fortunate people. What I talk about today is my lived experience and the reasons why I'm actually play a significant part in the area in regards to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. So that's a quick story of my life and where I come from and why I do the things that I do, like doing, coming to this particular summit today. I'd like to thank Tony and Vanessa for inviting me today too as well. And similarly, I'm probably going to cover some of the issues that Vanessa covered in regards to what Ken had also spoken about. And Ken was actually my predecessor before I took on the role of his directorship in New South Wales. So just to begin, the public health and I apologise if people have an understanding what the Public Health Association is, but I just need to go over in regards to the Public Health Association of Australia. It's recognised as the principal non-government organisation for public health in Australia and works to promote the health and wellbeing of all Australians. The association seeks better population health outcomes based on prevention, the social determinants of health and equity principles. Its vision is for a healthy region, a healthy nation, and a healthy people living in a healthy society and a sustaining environment while improving and promoting health for all. The association has around 1,900 individual members and represents over 40 professional groups concerned with the promotion of health at a population level. Our key roles include the development of policy, capacity building, and advocacy. Core to our work is an evidence-based drawn from a wide range of members working in public health practice, research, administration, and related fields who volunteer their time to inform policy, support advocacy, and assist in capacity building with the sector. I am one of 10 board members responsible for providing strategic advice to the organisation, but in particular in regards to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues. I commenced in the role of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Vice President position back in September 2015. I'm building on the work that Vanessa Lee undertook as the inaugural Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Vice President. What attracted me to the role was what the organisation's strategic focus was about, and in particular, it aligned quite significantly to the underlying principles in regards to what is required in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. So that for example, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health is not just about the physical wellbeing of individual, but the social, emotional and cultural wellbeing of the whole community. And this is the definition that arose out of the 1989 National Aboriginal Health Strategy, which we consider as a landmark document that formed the foundations for Aboriginal health policy in Australia. Similarly, this same definition is now currently applied in the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan that Ken spoke about this morning. The other reason I choose to work volunteer my time on the Public Health Association of Australia board is because of the nature of the membership. Vanessa touched on it a little bit as well, the efforts that need to be undertaken in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health requires a collective effort. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people ourselves cannot drive the change that's needed. Rather, we need to form strategic partnerships. And similarly, with the representation and membership of ACRA, we need your help to really make inroads into the stubborn statistics that I will share with you in a moment. So the report that Vanessa spoke about in regards to looking at the methodology and quality and validity of the data used to measure life expectancy. You know, I was excited that I was thinking similarly that, you know, the efforts that people had been putting in around closing the gap, that the statistics were showing us, you know, that improvements were made. But after reading that paper undertaken by the Sydney Centre for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Statistics based at Sydney University, it really questions the methodology, quality and validity of the data being used to actually say that improvements have been happening in the life expectancy of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So this, for me personally, has placed significant doubt around whether we're actually, you know, that the methodologies behind how they're measuring the successes of the efforts are actually propagating false claims. So I'm a little bit worried about that. But nonetheless, what we currently understand is that the health status of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is significantly worse than that of non-Indigenous Australian population. And for children, it is truly shocking. Despite comprising only 3% of the population, in 2011, the National Coronial Information System data for intentional self-harm showed that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children accounted for 80% of all deaths in the 4 to 11 years age group, 42.9% of all deaths in the 12 to 13 years, and 24.5% of deaths in the 14 to 15 years. This pattern continues into children and young people placed in out-of-home care, where over 10% are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders and account for high rates of intentional self-harm and suicidal behaviour compared to the general population. Across the lifespan, Indigenous people aged 35 to 44 years dying at 5 times the rate of the rest of the population. We heard Minister White talk about life expectancy, where Indigenous men die an average 10.6 years earlier than non-Indigenous men, and Indigenous women die an average of 9.5 years earlier. Overall, Indigenous Australians have a mortality rate of 1.6 times that of non-Indigenous people and are much more likely to die prematurely. Indigenous people experience higher incidence rates for many chronic diseases, and I'm sure some of you in this room would know this as well, including heart disease, diabetes, kidney disease, and including cancer. In 2007-11, Indigenous Australians were 5 times more likely to die from endocrine, nutritional, and metabolic conditions such as diabetes, and 3 times as likely to die from digestive conditions. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are also more likely to die from an accident or from suicide. In almost all areas, the determinants of health are poorer for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders than for the general population. Indigenous Australians have poorer education outcomes, higher rates of unemployment, greater poverty and psychological stress than non-Indigenous people. Almost half of all Indigenous adults reported that either they or a relative had been removed from their natural family. Indigenous people also have higher rates of health risks such as smoking, more than twice the non-Indigenous rate, poor nutrition and high obesity and overweight rates, low physical activity and excessive alcohol consumption. For example, 30% more Indigenous women than non-Indigenous consume higher levels of alcohol on a single occasion. In addition to the above, it is recognised that racism and discrimination is regarded as a significant health issue impacting on the social and emotional well-being of Indigenous Australians. A range of national and international studies have demonstrated the links between health and well-being and has confirmed this. In the 2012-13 health survey, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were 16% more likely to be treated badly in previous 12 months because they were Indigenous. A Victorian study, for example, reported that 97% of respondents experienced a form of racist episode within the preceding 12 months, with 35% experienced a racist incident in the previous month. Beyond Blue, in their 2014 study, discovered that non-Aboriginal Australians were not aware of discriminatory behaviour. Similarly, that behaviour such as employment discrimination were an unconscious act by the perpetrator. This study went on to identify that discrimination is commonly witnessed, with 40% seeing others avoid Indigenous Australians on public transport and 38% witnessing verbal abuse of Indigenous Australians. Almost a third witnessed employment discrimination against Indigenous Australians, and 9% admit they themselves discriminate in this context. One in four do not agree that discrimination has a negative personal impact for Indigenous Australians. More than half believe that being an Indigenous Australian makes it harder to succeed. Many believe it is acceptable to discriminate, with 21% admitting they would move away from an Indigenous Australian if they sat nearby, and 21% would watch an Indigenous Australian action when they were shopping. And you probably remember the Beyond Blue campaign around this particular time when this study was undertaken on TV. The Victorian study that I mentioned earlier also found that two-thirds of Indigenous Australians who participated in their survey reported being spat at and having something thrown at them, and 84% reported being sworn at or verbally abused. Similarly, that about a third of respondents experienced racism in health settings, 35% in housing, and 42% in employment, and 67% in shops. Today, Reconciliation Australia released their State of Reconciliation in Australia report. And again, their particular survey or study has indicated similar results as I have mentioned this morning. Other areas that warrants a mention includes the level of violence in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. For example, in 08 and 09, the hospitalisation rates for injuries caused by assault were 7 times higher for Indigenous men and 30 times higher for Indigenous women. We also know that in remote areas, Indigenous people were hospitalised as a result of family violence at 35.6 times the rate of others. The Indigenous imprisonment rate per 100,000 in adult population was 13 times the rate for non-Indigenous Australians, the rate increasing by 68% since 2000, with the gap continually widening. In terms of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people, they were 31 times as likely to be detained in juvenile correctional facilities as non-Indigenous youth. The rates of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children who were subject of a substantive child protection notification were 6 times the rate for non-Indigenous. Of interest, 40% were for neglect. So a lot of the issues are around child abuse and neglect, and 34% for emotional abuse. Sexual abuse was the least common for Indigenous Australians, and nationally that was around about 9%, compared with 15% for non-Indigenous children. Finally, I do need to mention the disability rates amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, which are approximately twice the rate of non-Indigenous people. It is therefore essential that we make visible the disability issues facing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So I've just really, you know, highlighted some of the significant issues that are evident in the statistics, and it does paint a really terrible picture. However, I am hopeful, again, that if there is this collective movement that brings together health professionals, the consumers and the providers, we can certainly make inroads into the efforts and build on the efforts that have been made to date. Being around for so long, I can positively say that there has been significant inroads into the way that our health system has been operating in terms of the commitment and goodwill that is currently out there to work with us on the business that needs to be done. In recognition of the inequities and poor health and wellbeing experienced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, the Public Health Association has been actively involved in contributing towards efforts to close the socio-economic, political and cultural and health gaps between Indigenous Australians and non-Indigenous people. In recent years, the PHA has established an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Vice President position on their board of directors, and Vanessa was, as I mentioned earlier, the first, and has done quite a significant amount of work in terms of her term of 4 years, and I'm going to describe some of that work in a minute. The position was created to demonstrate that the Public Health Association of Australia was serious about advocating for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues. The role of the position is to advise the board on matters that impact on the health and wellbeing of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. The association has also produced a number of policy and position statements in regard to specific Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues, including, for example, substance use policy, incarceration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people policy, and a food security for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's policy. Similarly, when developing policies or position statements, the PHA is also inclusive of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander points of reference. For example, in our mental health policy, we also continue to advocate for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities where mental health risks are prominent. Tobacco control policy points to the high rates of tobacco use in Indigenous communities and represents 20% cause of death, where smoking has been reported to be more than 50% and up to 80% in some communities. A prison health policy, we've been consistently supporting governments around the need to reduce the overrepresentation of Indigenous people in our prisons, and similarly with our domestic and family violence policy, which calls for a reduction of violence, particularly in regards to Indigenous Australians. In addition to these policy and position statements, we've also been actively involved in a range of national inquiries, which includes a submission in regards to intentional self-harm and suicidal behaviour in children. And similarly, the Senate Select Committee on Health to inquire into and report on health policy administration expenditure, where we continue to provide specific responses in regards to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues. In addition, the PHIA, and in particular the Vice President role, has positioned itself to be represented on key national forums, such as the Close the Gap campaign, organised through Oxfam and the Human Rights Commission, the National Tobacco Tackling Tobacco Smoking, Child Aware Approaches, and Australian Institute of Family Studies, Alcohol Advertising Review Board, and the Public Health Indigenous Leaders in Education Network. We've also ensured that the integration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues form a vital part, an element of our conferences, which will be quite a big agenda in regards to the international conference happening in 2017. Similarly, we've participated in a range of roundtables, and one of these has been in a participant in regards to the development of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan and the National Mental Health Commission Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Roundtable. So, essentially, the Public Health Association Australia, we will continue to support the Close the Gap agenda, and in particular, particularly the Close the Gap Oxfam agenda, because that is the people's movement. But similarly, we would be involved with whatever evolves from a government perspective too in regards to the closing the ING gap. Like ACRO, our position in regards to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues is that we will continue to argue for greater investment in health prevention and ensuring the primary healthcare sector is resourced appropriately and is culturally capable to assist with preventing the high rates of chronic diseases evidenced in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. Sadly, in recent times, we've witnessed erosion of a range of preventative health mechanisms, including a reconfiguration of the primary healthcare sector and programs, and most of you would know what those are. In addition, we remain committed and continue to support the Aboriginal community control health sector being the appropriate model in providing culturally responsive and comprehensive primary health care to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. And in regards to this sector, we're concerned about cuts to health flexible funds threatening vital services. Also, we're still unclear about how these cuts will be achieved, particularly as the significance of the cuts are in the vicinity of $200 million. On another note, we will continue to promote a response that addresses health equity by addressing the social determinants of health, and we're highly supportive of the Commonwealth Government's National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan. But critical to that plan will be the continued engagement of the National Health Leadership Forum. And what we know from history in regards to these great policy documents, which actually does have all the elements of what we're trying to achieve, is how it is implemented. Implementation is always the failings, particularly when you look at the complexities of our health system. Fundamental to any business that we do is acknowledging that the situations experienced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have their origins in past discriminatory policies and the impacts of colonialisation, which is again strongly reflected in the Commonwealth Government's National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan. Because if you have an appreciation of the history of the dislocation and dispossession and oppression of Indigenous Australians, you will then have an appreciation around the solutions that is required to address the complexities that we face. We'll also continue to support continued investment in research that creates the evidence about what health intervention works and why, and the translation of evidence-informed research in policies and design of services. This is a key and critical point in regards to ensuring that the research that is undertaken applies to the ethical standards around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, but more importantly, fundamental to any research that is done is that it benefits Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. The other challenge in regards to research is making sure that that research translates into service improvement. Advocate for improvements in data collection and quality. Our underpinning philosophy that all Australians, and particularly our Indigenous Australians, have a right to a healthy lifestyle, so that is a human rights-based approach. The other point is an imperative to engage, negotiate and consult with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people when designing policies and programs that aim to address the health disparities and outcomes. And fundamental to this approach is to draw on Indigenous collective voices. Continuation of the need of whole of government, whole of community response to resolve the health gap that is evident in Indigenous Australians. Reorientating health policy and healthcare that meets the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in different contexts. For example, we know that 30% of Indigenous Australians live in major cities, 20% in an inner regional town, 23% in outer regional areas, and 9% in remote areas, and 18% in very remote areas. And if you look at national policy over the years in regards to Indigenous health, a lot of the investment goes into the really remote areas. And that's not dismissing or disregarding the high levels of need there, but rather there needs to be a reconsideration around how you redistribute the resources that are available to support improvements in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. The other thing that we stand for is also to continue to build community and workforce capacity, particularly in regards to a culturally capable workforce and recognition of valuing the profession of Aboriginal health worker. There's probably two elements there that I really want to talk about, and that is being culturally capable. And what has been, I don't know whether it's been released, but certainly a three-year project that was undertaken by Health Workforce Australia in regards to, embedding cultural competency into health curriculum. That is quite a significant report that looks at how you actually build the cultural, it uses the term cultural capability, how you build cultural capability within the higher education health sector. And that's going to be quite a significant piece of work, because what that framework offers is a range of graduate attributes which provides the opportunities to actually build that ability within graduates. But the issue there is, when they leave, is the health system able to support those graduates in fulfilling their responsibility to remain culturally capable? I would argue that at the moment, probably not. But there are areas where we can make certainly, there are good things that are happening in terms of that area. The final thing is promoting the importance of employing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people into the mainstream health sector. I forgot to do my slides. Okay. So that's quite a significant amount of work that the Public Health Association has undertaken in recent years, and you could get a flavour of some of the fundamental principles and the drivers and also the efforts that we're actually attempting to do. And as you've given that the election is now just on a rise, that we would obviously want to continue to support those particular positions. But I think, one of the things that I am particularly keen to do is not only have a policy statement around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health that is very similar to something that ACRA is doing. So I commend ACRA in doing that, because I think that every organisation like ourselves need that. But also the areas that I think we want to also pursue is just to really support the government's efforts around implementation of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan, and similarly the agenda under the Close the Gap, as well as the Aboriginal Community Control Health Service, and also, support continued investment in tobacco use, as well as research. I don't know whether you want me to go into, am I my time up, or? Oh, really? And the reason I'm laughing is because I was stressing out about doing this talk. Vanessa, that's why Vanessa and I, you know, I ring her up and say, now, yeah, you sure you want me to do this? Anyway, so finally, what I'd like to highlight then, so I'll just go back to my notes. What we know works, and I've touched on some of this in my talk, so you, we know that you have to adopt a holistic approach. You have to have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people at the forefront of anything that you do. You need to have and recognise and value Indigenous and cultural knowledges, as well as, you know, having clear leadership and governance in place to oversight what has to actually occur. Similarly, you also need in employing Indigenous staff and involving them in the design and delivery of interventions. And finally, it is about developing the cultural capable staff and organisations. What I find that are the challenging things in terms of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health is that, you know, the constant change in the policy environment. You know, when the new government comes in, things change, and there's no consistency or long-term investment around really seeing how things work. But in addition to that, you know, the whole notion of, well, how do you actually fundamentally engage and negotiate with communities? I would argue that over time in the history of Australia, that that mechanism of engagement has eroded. However, the association, we're very pleased that Minister Nash is highly committed with working with the National Aboriginal Health Leadership Forum, which is made up of all the peak bodies nationally of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations. So I think that that mechanism, you can still use that. But I think the biggest challenge that faces the health sector and human services sector is that, yeah, sure, we can talk about all these high-level policy initiatives and what's happening, but how do you make that work on the ground? And that's where I think the greatest challenge is. And some of the things that I said about what we know works, you can actually translate that to the efforts that are required on the ground. And on that note, I'm going to say thank you and leave it at that.